I just want to introduce Dr. Wakefield now so he can spend some time going over the many, many years of research he's conducted on vaccines. Dr. Andrew Wakefield is an academic gastroenterologist. He received his medical degree from St. Mary's Hospital Medical School, part of the University of London, in 1981 and pursued a career in gastrointestinal surgery with a particular interest in inflammatory bowel disease. He has published over 130 original scientific articles, book chapters, and been invited for many scientific commentaries. One of the most prominent, of course, we all know is Dr. Wakefield's Lancet Medical Journal, a controversial paper that linked the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine to autism. So you'll hear a lot about that tonight. But anyway, I hope you all really appreciate that we have somebody in Austin who's dedicated his career to really researching the truth. And I think we all need to thank him for being here with us to share tonight. So anyway, without further ado, Dr. Andrew Wakefield.
Thank you. You may not be applauding at the end. I've actually been living in political and professional exile here in Austin for the last 7 years, and I just got found out. I never even knew this place existed. My son has been at UT. He graduates this year, so I hope to become a regular here from now on. Just to sort of set the scene, I'm an entirely traditional mainstream physician, and it's really a story about how to take a modestly and moderately successful career and flush it down the toilet. And when you go against policy and you threaten profit in medicine, that's what tends to happen. And it's really a story about this paper, a paper that we published in The Lancet in 1998. This is a humble case series. The way in which human disease is first described is that usually in specialist centers where you tend to see a concentration of particular cases. That is where novel disease syndromes are first witnessed. May I just ask at the outset, are there any people here whose lives are touched by autism? There are. And another question, are there any people, how many people here believe that vaccines are adequately tested for safety? No, please don't be shy. If you think vaccines are adequately tested for safety, please. I mean, there usually is a representative from Merck who comes along to monitor this. Seriously. And, okay, it's just to sort of gauge the audience. The way in which human diseases are first described are that they're usually picked up, it says in the literature, by an astute physician who recognizes a pattern of emergence of signs and symptoms in a small group of individuals that are so consistent and so idiosyncratic that they merit publication in their own right. So a paper like this is not a hypothesis testing paper. It's just saying this is what the parents say, and this is what we find, and this is what we think might be going on. In other words, it sets the stage for testing subsequent ideas about the disease. It does not, nor can it, say these children, for example, were damaged by a vaccine. But it sets the stage for taking that forward. Now, just to give you an example of that, Crohn's disease, which is my original interest, was first described in 14 adults, sorry. Autism, in 1943, was described in 11 children. Asperger's syndrome, which is that high-functioning part of autism, was described in 4 boys. And congenital rubella syndrome, and this is the importance of the parent in all of this, was not discovered by some brilliant doctor working at the National Institutes of Health. It was discovered because 2 mothers were sitting in an ophthalmologist's surgery in his office, and they were talking to each other about their children who had visual problems, and they both realized that they had suffered from rubella when they were pregnant. And they reported this to the doctor, and the doctor picked up on it, and that was the beginning of the discovery of congenital rubella syndrome and of rubella vaccination. That's where it began. So medicine begins and ends with the patient's narrative. And that is absolutely crucial. And that has been lost in this modern world of public health medicine, where the greater truth excludes the lesser. The greater good argument tends to prevail. Well, I don't believe in that argument. Even to articulate that argument, you need to know every part of the equation. The benefit of the infection, the risks of the infection, the benefits of the vaccine, and the risks of the vaccine. If you don't know all of those, you are not even in a position to entertain a discussion about the cost-benefit analysis. So, the first thing I want to do is get right into the fraud issue, because usually at book signings I just come along and I read a chapter and talk about things, but recently I've been accused of frank fraud by Brian Deer, a journalist in the UK, and the British Medical Journal. And I feel that the best thing to do is just get that right out the way and talk about it. And it's a fascinating story. This is what he said, and in fact he said this on the Gary Null Show. Wakefield has now been branded by the British Medical Journal a fraudster. They described his work as an elaborate fraud. He also went through the results, manually altering test results in this paper, and diagnosis and histories of the children so as to create the appearance that there was a link between MMR and autism. And the first thing, therefore, I want to talk about are the medical records. So here he is accusing me of going through the medical records and taking the information and changing it manually to include it in the paper. Now, just to set the scene for Brian Deer, who is something of an enigmatic character, the first time that he ever got involved in autism, he went to interview the mother, in fact, mother of the second child to be investigated in this paper. A very smart mother, a very articulate mother, who in fact was the first woman to phone me about her child on May the 17th, 1995. He got into her home, the home of this distraught mother with a badly damaged child, under a false name. He deliberately changed his name. He lied to her in order to deceive her, and in fact, he's quite proud of that. And that is just to set the scene of the person we are dealing with. Okay, this is what happens in the health service. The GP, the general practitioner, refers a patient to the expert, to the specialist. In this case, Professor John Walker Smith. Now, John Walker Smith is the world's founding father of the subject of pediatric gastroenterology. He's now retired. He's had an unimpeachable career, and he spent the whole of his life dedicated to the care of sick children. So he gets a letter from the general practitioner saying, "Dear Professor Walker Smith, would you please see this 5-year-old child with so on and so forth and advise?" Now, his letter is based upon his own records, the records that he holds in his office, and he distills those into a letter. We did not have access to those records in putting this paper together. What we had is his letter, and we also had something in the UK called the Red Book. And the Red Book is something that is given to every mother of a newborn child when they leave the hospital, and in there they fill in the immunizations, the growth, the height, the weight of the child, their development. And in England, a senior nurse visits the home of every child on a regular basis to assess their development. So what you have is a prospective developmental record of the child, every child. So you know if there is an aberration, if there is a problem with their development, because you've got this expert assessing it. So we had the Red Book. We also had the records from the hospital. So Professor Walker Smith's clinic records and what happened to that child in the hospital. And it was the distillation of the letter from the doctor and the Red Book and those records that went into the Lancet paper. And Brian Deer knew this. This is how the process works. But Brian Deer took the general practitioner records, which we did not have, and said that there were differences between what was written in those records and the Lancet paper, and therefore that was evidence of fraud. Let's just have a look at that in more detail. Let's take child one, the first child to be investigated. We said that the child's first behavioral problem started 1 week after MMR vaccine. That's what we were told by the mother. Brian Deer said that when he looked in the general practitioner's records, which he was able to obtain somehow, he saw that the child's mother had been concerned about his hearing 2 months before his MMR vaccine, and he said that that was the first sign of autism. Sometimes children with autism don't have hearing problems, but they sit there and you shout their name and they don't respond, and therefore the mother may be concerned that they have hearing problems. And so this is what he said was the first sign of autism. What we were told is that the first behavioral symptoms started with delirium for 3 days, 1 week after the MMR vaccine, and that is what we put into the Lancet paper. Now, some years later, when the General Medical Council struck us off, we had access to the general practitioner's records for the first time. And when I got those records, I went through them. And what it said in those records is mother concerned about hearing, discharge from left ear. What do you think that meant? An ear infection. Absolutely. This child had an ear infection. The mother was concerned about his hearing because he had an ear infection. So Brian Deere took those records, he took the bit he wanted, he discarded the bit he didn't want, and that is fraud. That is fraud. Child 2, the second child in the Lancet paper, he wrote, child 2 was diagnosed with regressive autism, which according to the Lancet paper started 2 weeks after his jab. However, the child's medical records, backed by numerous specialist assessments, said his problems began 3 to 5 months later. None of this is cited. None of this does he provide any reference for. The clinical records that we have, the child's psychiatrist at the Royal Free, Dr. Mark Brulovitz, wrote, started headbanging about 2 weeks after the MMR vaccine and hasn't looked right since. And in his discharge summary, had his MMR immunization, and 2 weeks following this, started headbanging behavior and screaming through the night. And these are characteristic features of autism, and that is what we reported. So what about the disease, the intestinal disease? Because what we did in this study, in this simple study, was to describe for the first time what appeared to be a novel inflammatory bowel disease in these children. Now, the parents had been going to the doctors saying, firstly, I'm worried about my child's development. They were absolutely fine. They had social skills. They were learning. They had words. They had language. And then they lost it after the vaccine. The doctor would say, no, they're just a boy. They're confused. They're just, you thought they were speaking, but they were just grunting and making noises. I had one where the child was saying helicopter. Helicopter is an extraordinarily complex word. A week after his MMR vaccine, he was saying copter. And a week after that, he was saying k. And a week after that, he said nothing, and he didn't speak again. So this is the kind of story that we heard. And the other thing is the parents would say, doctor, my child's having terrible diarrhea. He's banging his head. I'm sure he's in pain. There's something wrong with his tummy. The doctor would say, no, he's autistic. He's bound to have these problems. You see, that made absolutely no sense to us at all as gastroenterologists. See, these children were sick until proven otherwise. And what we discovered is they have a bowel disease. But Brian Deere didn't think so. Now, let me explain to you what happens. In the health service, any child, anybody who has a biopsy of any part of their body, that biopsy goes from the operating theatre down to the routine pathology laboratory. And there, it is looked at under the microscope by the duty pathologist of that week, the guy who is on the rota that week. Now, that person may have an interest in brain disease or breast cancer, but they're not in inflammatory bowel disease in children. So you're getting a general impression of what's going on. He writes a report, and that goes into the records. Now, Professor Walker Smith, throughout his career, has developed an unparalleled experience of bowel disease in children. So what he would do is meet on a weekly basis, and he did this for the entirety of his professional life. He would meet on a weekly basis with his team, and he would go through the biopsies in great detail. And he would bring his experience to bear on the diagnosis. And what he noted is that the pathologist, the routine pathologist, was missing disease in these children. And so not content with his own diagnosis, Professor Walker Smith then went to the senior bowel pathologist in the hospital, Professor Dillon, and he asked him to blindly review the biopsies. What that means is that Dr. Dillon has all the biopsies in front of him. He does not know the diagnosis. He doesn't know the symptoms. He doesn't know the outcome. He knows nothing about the children. All he has are the biopsies, and he scores them on a standard scoring sheet. And this is the kind of scoring sheet that he scores them on. And this is research. This is something that I was involved in. Now, really, in a nutshell, what this shows is various degrees of inflammation: none, mild, moderate, severe, and a final score, 1, 2, 0, 1, 2, or 3, and then various features down that side of inflammation, acute inflammation. It doesn't worry about the details, but this is a systematic way of scoring the biopsies and doing it in a way that is reproducible. And it is the result of that process, that diligent process, that went into the Lancet paper. Brian Deer knew all of that. And Professor Walker-Smith, in his testimony before the General Medical Council, said this was nothing to do with me. This was his initiative, Dr. Dillon the expert, systematic analysis that was blinded, the highest level of scientific rigor, and it was that result that was entered into the paper. Brian Deer took the routine reports and said they were different from what was in the paper, and that was evidence of fraud. What he omitted is this whole process of due diligence, which is the reason why tertiary referral centers of excellence exist. That's why they're there, is to do this kind of thing so that we do not miss disease. And yet Brian Deer went from there to there and said it was fraud. The other thing that he did, it was said that we did not have ethical approval for that process, for the analysis of the biopsies. One of the charges that was sustained against us is that we didn't have ethical approval. Now, Brian Deer obtained documents right at the beginning of his investigation from the hospital. And he took those documents and he submitted them in his complaint to our regulatory body, the General Medical Council in the UK. Or did he? No, he didn't. He kept some documents to the side. And what he kept to the side were the key documents that disclosed the fact that we did have ethical approval for that study, and here it is. 16295, ethical approval for study of biopsies that was awarded in 1995, 1 year before we ever saw these children. And this was withheld. This vital evidence was deliberately withheld, I believe, by Mr. Deer from the General Medical Council because it ran counter to his argument. And every child's records presented to the GMC of those 12 children, there was a consent form signed by the parents that was relevant to that ethical approval. In other words, you've got hard evidence that there is a consent form in the notes for that research project and no other consent form at all for any other project. And yet they found us guilty of doing this without ethical approval. It's an extraordinary situation. Brian Deer did not reserve his ire for me or for my colleagues. This is what he said on the blogs about parents of children with autism: the festering nastiness, the creepy repetitiveness, the Weasley deceitful obsessiveness, all signal pathology to me. And they wonder why their children have problems with their brains. So this is the kind of person who portrays himself as the guardian of children with this disorder. So what has happened in the last 15 years? Where have we come from? Where are we now? This, when I first got into it, was the status quo. This is what people believed about autism, that it was a psychiatric disorder. You may know that this started as being the mother's fault. Until relatively recently, this was the refrigerator mother. Bruno Bettelheim went one stage further and said these children lived in fear of their lives because their mother wanted to kill them. This is the belief. I mean, medicine does this. When medicine doesn't have an explanation for anything, it blames someone else. Exquisite arrogance. There's no epidemic. It's an ancient disorder. It's always been around. Well, when I was at medical school, we weren't even taught about it. There were no cases of autism before the 1930s. When I was at medical school, it was 1 to 2 in 10,000. And now in the UK, it's 1 in 58 children. And it's likely to be exactly the same here. It is an epidemic. In two generations, it has gone through the roof. And we can talk about the reasons why. And people say, we're just better at making the diagnosis. We're just getting cleverer. We've changed the criteria. No, all of these are reasonable hypotheses. They've been looked at. They do not explain this extraordinary rise in the disease. The argument was that it's genetic. It's still the parents' fault, but now it's their genes and not the mother trying to kill the child. It's definitely not the environment, and it's most certainly not something we're doing to the environment. It's not toxins. Regression is extremely rare. Very interesting point. Leo Kanner's children in 1943 at Johns Hopkins appeared to have problems from the beginning. They were children who never wanted to be picked up. They never made a fuss. They never made a noise. They never engaged or spoke. They were autistic, apparently, from the word go. What we're dealing with now, for the majority of cases, I believe, certainly the ones that we see, are children who develop normally, and then suddenly they crash, and they lose acquired skills, or they plateau out. There is no intestinal disease. Diarrhea 12 times a day is just part of autism. That exclusion diets, another insight provided by parents, are unhelpful. In fact, they're hocus-pocus, and there's no recovery. Get over it. Put your child in a home and move on. This was, until very recently, indeed in some centers here, still in this country, some centers that still use electrotherapy to aversion therapy on children. Can you believe that's still allowed in the state of Massachusetts, to electrocute children to stop them doing certain behaviors? I mean, unbelievable. So this is what's happened around the world in autism. This is a study that came from the University of California looking at the incidence of autism, the number of new cases occurring year on year, broken down in this case by birth year. And California, Denmark, and Japan are shown. So relatively disparate genetic populations. And what you can see is this looked at the hockey stick effect, the relatively flat plateau that went up just with the rise in population, and then suddenly this epidemic effect. And what is interesting is it's occurred at the same point in these countries. In children born in such a narrow range as 1988 and 89, there was this sudden inflection, and it took off in these different countries. This is very, very important because it says this is environmental. This must be environmental. You don't have genetic epidemics. The human gene evolves over thousands and thousands of years. You do not have genetic epidemics. This is an environmental factor, and it seems to be common, a common denominator to these different countries. In just 2 years, it changed. And that gives you a very, very useful pointer as to what may have changed in the environment in those countries at that point. And this is the worldwide figures. And you can see this is an extraordinary change in the rate of this disease. And people say we're just getting better at making the diagnosis. Well, when I was at the Royal Free, the cleaning woman used to make the diagnosis of autism. You cannot miss these children. And in 1994, the diagnostic criteria changed, but it was a corrective narrowing of the criteria. It wasn't a broadening of the criteria. It was called a corrective narrowing. So something in the environment happened first to children born at the end of the 80s. And that, I think, is a very important clue. So, genetics. Billions of dollars invested in genetics, academically of interest, a reasonable starting point, but nothing has been consistent or reproducible. For the great majority of people, 97% plus, there is no evidence that this is a genetic disorder. And there is no genetic epidemic, as I've said. So we're slowly working through these, not environmental. It must be environmental. And the mainstream opinion now that's emerging is not only that it's environmental, this is a mainstream view, it's time to start looking for the environmental culprits that's led to this dramatic increase. And Dr. Landrigan from Mount Sinai Hospital, the likelihood is high that many of the materials, that's the toxins in the environment, have the potential to cause injury to the developing brain and to produce neurodevelopmental disorders, possibly autism among them. And he described this as a massive toxicological experiment with our children. This is a talk that he gave to the Institute of Medicine in Washington. So what we have going on at the moment is a massive toxicological experiment. So regression is extremely rare. As I said, no regression actually becomes the main phenotype of this disease that we see now. Exclusion diets were until recently, until the last 10 years, something that mainstream medicine didn't want to have anything to do with. And yet parents said time and time again, when I put my child on a gluten-free diet or a casein-free diet, cow's milk products, they get dramatically better. And we heard this story time and time again, and when they put them on a casein-free diet, cow's milk, you know, dairy product-free, the first thing that changed is their sleep. The children started sleeping. And this was so consistent. And then they put them on a gluten-free diet. The children started speaking and recovering. Now, gastroenterologists see this. We see this with celiac disease, a primary bowel disease associated with gluten intolerance. You go on a gluten-free diet, and if you're a kid, then your grades at school improve, your depression lifts, you sleep. This has been known to gastroenterologists for a long, long time. This gut-brain link is not something that is alien to gastroenterologists. But to psychiatrists and psychologists, it was much more of a challenge. This is a disease that's up here. Please don't, you know, threaten the status quo. This is my disease, my territory. Possibly not. And recovery. Well, just to reassure you now that there is recovery to a greater or lesser extent. Children can get a lot better. And we noticed that when we treated the bowel disease that I'll talk about in a moment in the UK with standard medication that we would use for Crohn's or colitis, anti-inflammatory medication, then not only did the bowel disease get better, but the children started speaking, smiling, laughing, sleeping. We may not have cured their autism, but it made a huge difference to their quality of life, and it made it much easier to teach them. And when you could teach them with special techniques, then they got the best of everything. And no intestinal disease are never replicated. So the word in the media that keeps being repeated, apart from Dr. Wakefield discredited, is that none of this work has ever been replicated. This is the kind of child that we dealt with. And this is a little boy from the UK who couldn't get the care he needed in the UK and came to Dr. Krigsman, my colleague in New York. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to tell that this child is sick. He has no muscle mass, he's wasted, he has a grossly distended abdomen, which you can see here in profile. He looks like a child from a famine zone from West Africa. And yet the person who's under investigation in this family is who? The mother. By Child Protective Services, because clearly she's starving her child. And yet behind him is his sister. And you can see that his sister is perfectly well nourished. The mother is not starving this child. This is another child that came to us. This little boy was in such pain from his abdomen that he would beat his head against a wall in order to render himself unconscious to get away from that pain. And this was said to be just autistic behavior. No, it was not. And this is the travesty of this disorder. It takes a lot to shock me now, but I can't look at this without being shocked. And this mother drove down because she couldn't fly with the child's grandmother to Austin to be seen. And again, he was so distraught on the way that they had to stop at a hospital. And in the emergency room, you can imagine what happened. The first thing was, this is child abuse. No, it wasn't. And in fact, fortunately, the doctor in the emergency room recognized the child's autistic behavior and realized that this was not, in fact, child abuse and sent them down to us in Texas. This little boy would lean on the furniture for hours a day in this position. The doctors would say, that's just autism. Kids with autism do that. It's just inappropriate behavior. No, it isn't. It's entirely appropriate. Why? Because this child has abdominal pain. Now, he's lost the ability to speak. He can't tell his mother he's got abdominal pain. So he leans on his abdomen to relieve that pain. This is entirely appropriate behavior. It's entirely appropriate behavior in a child who's in pain who has lost the ability to communicate. And we know this because when his bowel disease is diagnosed and treated, he stops doing this. He doesn't do it anymore. This little guy would sleep like this. A patient of Dr. Krigsman's, he would sleep all night like this, on his ball with his head on his little dog there. And he was in pain. And when you treated his bowel disease, got rid of the pain, he didn't do this anymore. This is the bowel disease that Brian Deere thinks these children don't have. Now, this is a pill cam image. So this is where you swallow that little capsule that takes the camera that takes 3 frames a second. It goes through your small intestine, which is an area that, as gastroenterologists, we couldn't see before. We could see the top end and the bottom end. We couldn't see the bit in the middle. This is, you can see very clearly these areas of inflammation, reddening, sharply demarcated, and an ulcer down here. Okay, now these didn't come from me. They didn't come from Professor Walker Smith. They didn't come from Dr. Krigsman. They came from someone who's replicated the disease in Turin in Italy, Dr. Federico Balzola. And this disease has now been replicated in 5 different countries around the world. So the argument that it's not been replicated is false. This is that little boy that I showed you at the beginning with the distended abdomen. And this is a colonoscopy view. This is the view inside the colon. You can see it's red, but More importantly, you see these little white dots. These are ulcers, like the ulcers you'd get in your mouth, very painful. And this boy had ulcers right the way out through his intestine. And this is looks like early Crohn's disease. We don't think it is early Crohn's disease, at least we hope it isn't. But nonetheless, this is the disease with which he was suffering for a long time and could not get care in the United Kingdom. So he had to come to the US. People had become so frightened because of the vaccine association that these children were being sent away from hospital in distress because no one wanted to touch them. It's like they had leprosy. And here he is, just 1 month after appropriate therapy. Okay? Just 1 month. There's no rocket science. This is not difficult. This is entirely straightforward clinical medicine. It's taking the mother's story about her child, interpreting it, doing the tests, and treating the child. This is not complicated. And here he is 1 month later, simply on anti-inflammatories and a diet, and his life is transformed. He's still autistic because the damage has been there for a long time. Had we got to him earlier, it may have been a very different story. We don't know. But certainly our impression is that the earlier we see children, the earlier we catch them and treat them aggressively, the earlier we intervene both with educational therapy and with medical therapy, then we can get the best for these children. How common are bowel symptoms in autism? I just put these references up if anybody wants to know them. But about 45 to 80% of children have bowel symptoms, current gastrointestinal symptoms. And how common is this bowel inflammation now in these replication studies around the world in children with autism? Well, it's high, 76 to 100%. And so if you, and there are three more studies that replicate it, how common is autism? Well, as I say, in the UK and in the US, I have no doubt, it's of the order of 1 in 66, 1 in 50, but it's getting higher every year. These are old numbers now. These are 5 years old, these numbers. So it's very high. So what I'm saying is that the bowel problem in children with autism is big. It is a big, big problem. And if it's something that we understand, because we spend a lot of years working on Crohn's and colitis, so it's something that we can do something about based upon current knowledge, and we can get children a great deal better. So, no intestinal disease. Well, this is the current state of affairs, 15 years on. The world is changing. It's frustratingly slow for parents of affected children who don't see the improvement, but this is the impact that parents have had, not the medical profession. The medical profession has largely got in the way of this. It hasn't just been negative, it's been obstructive to progress. And this agenda has been forced by parents and not by doctors. So what is the link between the bowel and the brain? This is a fascinating story. And the chief medical officer in the UK, Sir Kenneth Cowman, came up to me once, and he's like the Surgeon General, and he said, I just don't get this gut-brain link. How does that work? I don't believe it. I said, well, let's go and have a beer, and I'll show you. You know. Now, you get it. He didn't. He didn't. He just stood there. I don't like beer. You know, we treat psychological and psychiatric disease with oral medication. These drugs have to get through the gut into the bloodstream to affect the brain. Known causes of autism include, for example, phenylketonuria, the thing that kids have the heel prick test for. And that is a toxic reaction to a metabolite of phenylalanine in the diet that these children can't metabolize. It poisons the brain. A gut-brain axis. There are two drugs that we know cause autism when taken by the mother during pregnancy, thalidomide, the antiemetic drug, and sodium valproate, the anti-seizure drug. These drugs have to get through the gut to the brain. In fact, in this case, from the gut of the mother right through into the brain of the child. So the gut-brain axis operates. We know it operates. We see it all the time in gastroenterology, in celiac disease, or in liver failure. The more jaundiced a patient becomes as their liver failed, then they slip into a coma and they die. And the way you reverse that process is to treat the gut. You don't treat the brain. You get rid of the bacteria in the gut, you put them on a special diet, and they come out of coma and get better. The gut-brain axis is real, except for the chief medical officer. Now, this is this is a very recent paper, and I just want to illustrate this, where this is going and why this is such an exciting field, is that this paper came out recently in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and it shows that the bacteria in your intestine influence your behavior and your brain development. Now, that's really interesting. Your brain development, the bacteria in your gut. We're more bug than we like to think. I went to a lecture recently in a scientist from Imperial College in London who studies a thing called metabolomics. And his statement was that we are 9/10 bacteria and 1/10 human. The health, for metabolism, for the generation of vitamins, for detoxification of drugs, we rely upon our gut bacteria. And now it appears we rely upon our gut bacteria for brain development and behavior. And that's fascinating. No mammal is an island. So vaccines, this is where one's career really takes a bit of a tumble. The parents came to us, and let me just give this some context. They came to us and they said, I believe that my child has a bowel disease. And I believe that it's related to their autism. And the doctors had said, no, you're wrong. So the parents were right. So when they come to us and say, my child regressed after a vaccine, they had 4 days of fever, they slept, they never woke up, the same child. When they woke up, they were completely different. And the doctor said, no, it's coincidence. Is that a good starting point in medicine? Is coincidence a good starting point? No. It's something that you come to after you've eliminated every other possibility. Only when you've done that process of due diligence in medicine can you say it is likely, in the absence of anything else, that this is coincidence. You do not start from that point, and that's where medicine started with this. If these children had regressed after natural chickenpox, people would have said, wow, that's bad. We need to do something about that. But because it was a vaccine, it couldn't possibly happen. And this is the sort of cognitive dissonance in which we live. And I'm not alone in fearing this. 89% of parents in a recent poll from the University of Michigan put vaccine safety research as their number one medical priority. So parents are concerned. They're genuinely concerned. They're not concerned because I've caused a scare. My colleagues and I responded to a scare. We responded to a legacy that in the UK, we introduced 3 brands of the MMR vaccine. 2 had to be withdrawn because they caused meningitis. And yet the head of immunization in the UK said that this is a vaccine with an exemplary safety record. 2/3 withdrawn for safety reasons, please. So the scare exists because parents believe there is a problem, not because of me. As I say, we responded to the scare. So the mainstream view is coincidence. Well, we've dealt with that, that vaccine safety is proven, and we can look at that now, that multiple studies confirm that there's no autism link and that it's safe to receive multiple vaccines at once, despite the fact that it's never been studied. Never. Coincidence, I've said, is a last resort. The safety concerns, it's proven that you can have multiple concurrent vaccines and that the schedule, it's safe, is safe. So that what children have from day one of life, the hepatitis B vaccine, right the way through to their preschool boosters, over 40 vaccines, that's perfectly safe, and yet it's never been tested. Can you believe that? What about vaccine excipients? What about what we find in vaccines other than just the bug itself, the antigen itself? So what do we find in vaccines? Aluminum salts, antibiotics, formaldehyde, stabilizers, preservatives, including mercury preservatives, a whole bunch of stuff about which the safety is not known. The mercury itself, what a mixture. The mercury itself was grandfathered in by the FDA because it had been in medications for years. So there was no safety study at all of thimerosal. And what about other things that we find in vaccines? Adventitious agents. Other viruses. Let me just give you one example. This is the rotavirus vaccine. In the UK, we don't use the rotavirus vaccine because we don't see a need for it. So why is it being used here?
Money.
It was produced for third world countries. And yet it's now mandated in this country. Well, in March 2010, using some modern and sophisticated molecular technology, a pig virus was found in the rotavirus vaccine made by GlaxoSmithKline. And this is elements, the DNA fragments of this pig virus, porcine circovirus type 1. Now, it's important to say that this virus has never been shown to produce disease in humans or in pigs. But the FDA did the right thing, and they suspended the use of this GlaxoSmithKline vaccine, a British company, in the States. Using the same technology, in May 2010, two pig viruses were identified in the Merck rotavirus vaccine, porcine circovirus type 1 and porcine circovirus type 2. Now, the porcine circovirus type 2 does cause disease. It causes a wasting AIDS-like disease in young pigs. So the FDA met again, and what did they do? They put both vaccines back on the market. And they said the benefits far outweigh the risks. How can you possibly know what the risk? They didn't even know it was there in the first place. How can they possibly say what the risks are? They have no idea whatsoever. That is a deception. You tell this pig that the benefits outweigh the risk. This is a pig with porcine circovirus type 2 infection. Okay? This is disease. And they say the benefits outweigh the risk, and they have no idea what the short, medium, or long-term consequences of putting that agent in there are. And this is Dr. Landrigan's words as before. This is a massive toxicological experiment with our children. What about simultaneous vaccination?
Well, what are the benefits?
What are the benefits? That's a very, very good question. This is the CDC. So again, this is their words. Simultaneous vaccination is incompletely studied at the time of licensure. So in other words, the time that it's actually put into children, no one's looked at the interaction between different viruses, different vaccines, between, for example, aluminum and live viruses, between the mercury and live viruses and mercury and aluminum. We now know these potentiate each other, but it was never studied. And the safety of the childhood vaccine schedule is untested. So, thimerosal and autism, the science has proven there's no link. Well, let's just look at that. And again, this is not my analysis. This was an independent analysis conducted by Kathy DeSoto at the University of Northern Iowa. And she reviewed all of the raw data, all of the papers that gave raw data on this. She reviewed 58 research articles on a link between autism and one or more toxic heavy metals. 15 were evidence against a link. In contrast, 74% supported a link. So you are told in the media that thimerosal is safe and it's been ruled out of autism. No, this is what the science actually says. You have been lied to. And in fact, she took one of these studies and reanalyzed it, a major study, and showed that they'd done the analysis wrong. And when she did it right, then it showed there was an association. Special educational needs in boys receiving the hepatitis triple series compared to those who did not receive it, had 9 times the rate of special educational needs. Peer-reviewed and published data. This is not evidence against an association. When this same group looked at autism specifically in a separate paper, then the boys who'd received the hepatitis B vaccine at less than 1 month, remember it's usually given on the day of birth, had a 3-fold increased risk of autism compared with those in whom it was delayed or did not receive it. This is strong evidence of causation. In a court of law, you need a 2-fold increased risk to persuade the judge, and here we have a 3-fold increased risk. What about measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine? The same Dr. Landrigan said to the Institute of Medicine, the Japanese study is the best evidence that MMR does not cause autism, and this is how I got into this through MMR. MMR, like the UK, it's a little story that I perhaps should tell you, and that is, in the UK, and one of the reasons they had to silence me in the UK is that when MMR was introduced at the end of the 80s, we had 3 options. One was the Merck vaccine, MMR2, made in America. The other was the Aventis Pasteur Meyrieux vaccine from France, Belgium, and the other was GlaxoSmithKline's MMR Pluserix. Now, Pluserix was being used under a different name in Canada, and it was causing meningitis. And so it was withdrawn very quickly. And the person involved in those trials in Canada was brought over to the UK to advise the British government on the introduction of this vaccine because they wanted to use the GlaxoSmithKline vaccine. And he said, don't do it. It's causing this problem. And they ignored him. In the same month that it was withdrawn in Canada, it was licensed in the UK. The only thing that had changed was its name. It changed from Trivirix to Pluzarix. Otherwise, it was identical. And reports of meningitis kept coming in and coming in, and they ignored them until 4 years later. They did a study, and they found the rate of meningitis was 100 times that they predicted from what's called passive surveillance, just waiting for reports to come in. And the vaccine was withdrawn overnight. So they were warned, and they did it anyway. And a lot of children were hurt as a consequence. Why did they do it? Because it was cheaper. And because it was the home team, GlaxoSmithKline. So they put the price of a vaccine before the health of children. And that's what he told me on a station in Newcastle in the north of England as a whistleblower. One of the reasons why I had to continue this work, and one of the reasons why they had to silence me. Why? Because Glaxo, well, it wasn't Glaxo at the time, it was SmithKline Beecham, did not want to introduce the vaccine. He said that there were problems. They were aware of these problems in Canada, and they were reluctant to face the legal consequences of that. And it seems that the British government did a deal with them, that they indemnified them. They assumed their liability in order to get this vaccine on the market. And so when I got involved in the MMR litigation in the UK, I thought that we were suing the manufacturers. No, we weren't. It was the government that was on the hook, and it was the government who contacted the dean of the medical school and tried to stop my work, and eventually did in the UK. So in Japan, the same MMR vaccine was withdrawn because it was causing problems. Now let's go back into the rubella vaccine in Japan was introduced in 1977, the measles vaccine on its own, 78, and MMR was introduced in 1989. And the majority were vaccinated at 12 months of age. And this study, I'm going to show you very briefly just one graph. This is the Japanese effect in one ward, one area of Japan. This, at the bottom of the graph, is around the rate of autism, the incidence of autism before the vaccine was introduced, less than 20 per 10,000. And you can see what happened when the vaccine was introduced. This is year of birth along the bottom. The first children to receive the vaccine showed a sharp increase in this disorder. Then the vaccine was withdrawn because it was causing meningitis, and the rate of autism went down. But the authors said that MMR in Japan was never reintroduced, never reintroduced. They don't use it now. But when they looked at the numbers of autism, it went skyrocketing after this period where it had gone down. So they said it can't be MMR. MMR vaccine cannot do this because the rate of autism has rocketed to this point. Now, on the face of it, that's a reasonable argument, except they hadn't read what we'd written in the first place. In fact, what happened in Japan, at the bottom of this curve here, is that they introduced a new policy. And that policy was to give children the measles and rubella vaccine by separate injections on the same day, and to give them the mumps vaccine 4 weeks later. Now, in terms of viral behavior, that's doing the same thing. It's pretty much doing the same thing as giving MMR. Just because you're giving them by separate injections doesn't mean you're not getting the same impact of these two viruses occurring at the same time. And so even though that doesn't argue that MMR is the cause, it simply does not rule out the possibility that we're looking at exactly the same effect. So you really need to do your work. What about timing of exposure? When we get exposed, the age at which we're exposed to infection makes a huge difference to the outcome. If you get chickenpox when you're a child, it's trivial. If you get it when you're an adult, it's not. If you get mumps when you're a child, trivial. If you get mumps when you're a post-adolescent boy, you can get orchitis and sterility, testicular inflammation. Very different outcome from the same infection according to the age at which you get it. So here's just one example. This is a big study that took place in Manitoba, University of Manitoba. Over 11,500 children who received at least 4 doses of the DPT vaccine, the risk of asthma was halved if you delayed the first dose by just 2 months. Now, this is an extremely important study because it's saying you don't have to stop vaccinating. You just change the schedule and you can reduce the risk of this devastating disease by a whole lot. And if you delay the first three doses of this vaccine, then you reduce the risk to a third. So you see this biological gradient effect is very powerful evidence that this vaccine, according to the age at which it's given, is a risk for asthma. And there are 5,000 deaths a year in this country from asthma. So this is a huge issue. It would be enough, you would think, to cause the regulatory authorities to say, maybe we should do this in the interests of children. But no, nothing has happened. We've seen the same thing with MMR vaccine. People say there's no association. Huge epidemiological studies have been done. They show there's no effect. No, they don't. There was a study by Dr. Frank DiStefano from the CDC where they looked at just this issue, the age of MMR vaccination and autism risk, and they found that if you were vaccinated younger, your risk was significantly greater. And yet that was published as a negative study, a study that's shown no effect. They tested a hypothesis, they found a significant effect, and then they sought to dismiss it by saying this is an artifact of the vaccine requirements of special educational preschool children. Now that argument is only possibly tenable if the vaccination requirements for special ed preschool children are any different from those of regular ed preschool children. They are not. They are identical. In other words, it's a specious argument. It's a deception. They found an effect and they put it out there as a negative study. So the link to autism is most certainly not disproven, and it's not safe to receive multiple vaccines. Dr. Paul Offit, who in fact was the inventor of that rotavirus vaccine that contained the pig viruses, and also sits on the committee that approves vaccines as well, no conflict there, said that it is safe for a child to receive 10,000, 100,000 vaccine antigens at once. 100,000. This has never been put to any test whatsoever. So bend over, Dr. Offit, I say. So how do we solve this problem? How do we actually address this problem? We have to define the question. And the question that we're pursuing, that my research group and the charity I work with are pursuing, is that we are poisoning children. And we are giving them, from a very early age, preservatives like thimerosal, mercury. Now, it was taken out. It was advised to be taken out. There was no mandate to take this out. Drug companies were advised to take this out of vaccines in children. So at the same time that they took it out, they put it back in the flu vaccine, given now to pregnant mothers and to when the child is at their most vulnerable and to children of 6 months of age, and in the meningococcal vaccine. Now, why would you do that? Why would you take out a poison which apparently is only second to plutonium on the planet as a toxin? Why would you take it out on the one hand and then put it back on the other? I think my friend Alex Jones would have a few thoughts on that one. And what about aluminum? Aluminum is put in there to boost the immune response. Without aluminum as an adjuvant, the vaccine wouldn't work. And yet aluminum is known to be a poison to the immune system and to the brain. So we put these things in there, and I believe we poison the children. We damage their immune system. We render their brain susceptible. And then we give them a live viral vaccine like MMR. And the immune system puts up its hands and says, I just don't get this. Now, I don't know that that's what's happening, but that's what I believe what's happening in some children, and that's what needs to be looked at. And the biohazard that we're producing is incalculable. Now, as I say, the vaccine schedule has never been tested for safety. The World Health Organization recommendations to manufacturers are these. Because a lot of these viruses are primate viruses, they only infect monkeys and up, then you can't test them out in subprimate species. Measles is an example. So the World Health Organization recommends to the vaccine manufacturer that they use no fewer than 10 primates. Now, for the manufacturer, that will mean 10 primates. And what they do is they inject the vaccine antigen, but they don't inject the whole vaccine, they just the measles itself. They don't inject it under the skin, they inject it directly into the brain, into the thalamus of the brain. And they observe the animals for 17 to 21 days, and then they sacrifice them and look at the brain under the microscope for evidence of damage. The problem is that they don't include any controls. No animals that have had saline injected into the brain, so you know your effect is or isn't due to the vaccine itself. This is not a scientific experiment. It has no merit, no value whatsoever, because you do not know whether the effects that you're seeing down the microscope are simply a consequence of putting a needle or saline into the brain. Now, if an animal dies during the first 48 hours, you can replace them in the experiment. It's the animal's fault for dying. It's not the vaccine's fault. And if more than 20% of the animals die over the course of the whole experiment, you can scrap it and start again. This is what they do before the vaccine antigen is put into children. So in order to address this, some years ago at the University of Pittsburgh, we decided to do a proper study. And the other thing is they don't require any age specification. So these could be adult primates that have an entirely different immune response to infants. So at the University of Pittsburgh, at the primate center, we said, right, let's just take infant rhesus macaques and give them the vaccine schedule in an age and dose-adjusted fashion that children had in the 1990s when thimerosal use was at its most enthusiastic. And I said I would never do experiments on primates, but we were faced with this catastrophe, this tsunami of children with autism and no answers. No answers and no will to seek an answer on behalf of the federal government. So we decided that we would do what should have been done a long time ago. And this is the first study that was published. And this looks at the acquisition of survival skills in the first 14 days of life. Now, what I mean by that are there are some essential survival skills in young infants, such as sucking, rooting, snouting, feeding reflexes. If you don't feed in the first few days of life in the wild, you will die. And so what we're able to do here is compare the acquisition of those skills in animals that have received just the hepatitis B vaccine on day one of life, or saline as a control. What we find is this. This is what's called a cumulative survival curve. It looks at the proportion of animals left in the experiment over time along the bottom. The blue is the unvaccinated, the green are the vaccinated, and you can see that in blue, every time this goes down, another animal acquires this skill, and this is the root reflex. And there is a significant difference, a highly significant difference in the acquisition of this survival reflex between the unvaccinated and the vaccinated. It is delayed in those receiving the hepatitis B vaccine. If you look at the suck reflex, you see exactly the same thing. And if you look at the snout reflex, you see the same thing. Some animals not achieving this reflex. This is where you stroke the nose and they move their head upwards towards the nipple. So this is an extraordinary effect. The detriment was always seen in the vaccinated animals. And this is just the first shot on the first day of life. The second study was looking at neuroimaging in the brain. In children with autism, there is often rapid growth of the brain and enlarged head size. And this is due to underlying abnormalities in brain growth, and certain areas of the brain are particularly susceptible. So could we reproduce this by scanning these animals? Now, this is just a series of scans. This is a positron emission tomography looking at the binding of a morphine-like receptor in the brain, which has been implicated in autism, in a particular area that's involved in emotion called the amygdala. This is the normal response. So T1 is before MMR, T2 is after MMR, and this on the top is the animal that just received the saline. And you can see that there is a natural decline in the activity of this receptor. You see the signal, the color signal lessens. However, in the vaccinated animals, it doesn't decline. In fact, if anything, it increases. So there is not only structural change in the brain, the brains are larger in these animals, but they are functionally different as well as a consequence of vaccination. Now, here's the question. If they had done these studies when they should have done them, would they have licensed the schedule? If you came out of a laboratory of Big Pharma and you with these results of your primate study before putting this into children, and you said, well, I've got these really, really interesting findings. These animals are not acquiring their reflexes. Who is going to put that on the market? No one. And yet the study wasn't done when it should have been done. And I believe that that's the implication for what we're looking at. How will we resolve the issue of vaccines and causation? Well, this sort of prospective infant rhesus macaque, this non-human primate study, is going to be essential. Why? Because it's the model they use. They can't turn around and say it's just an animal and therefore it doesn't count. It's the model they use for testing these vaccines before putting them into children. So they can't use that argument. a large study of unvaccinated children, children who've never been vaccinated compared to those who've been fully vaccinated, looking at total health outcomes. That's essential, and the government have refused to do this study. What is the health, medium, short, long-term health of unvaccinated children, like the Amish or homeschoolers or whatever it might be, compared with those who've been fully vaccinated? And I suspect they fear doing this study for the very reason that they already know the answer. Rechallenge. What happens if I give you a drug and you develop a rash? Well, that could be coincidence. If I give you the same drug 5 years later and you develop the same rash, that is not coincidence. That is causation until proven otherwise. It's called rechallenge. So what happens to children who've had two shots of MMR or another vaccine compared with those who've got one? What we did in the UK was asked the objective question, is the bowel disease worse in kids who've got two shots of MMR and regressed into autism compared with those who got one shot only and regressed into autism? And the answer is yes. The bowel disease is systematically worse in those who got two shots. That is powerful evidence of causation. And migration studies, and I won't go into details of these here, but this is looking at, for example, the Somali population in Minnesota. In Somalia, in the Horn of Africa and East Africa, there is no word for autism. They don't have autism. And yet, when the children are born to Somali parents in Minnesota or Sweden or the UK, then the rate of autism is about 1 in 28 children. Staggering difference. So there seems to be some genetic predisposition, but that must be in response to an environmental exposure that doesn't occur in Somalia, but does occur in these first world countries. And so there could be very important clues coming from that. Do vaccines cause autism? I don't know. But yes, according to Professor Sir Michael Rutter. Professor Sir Michael Rutter, ironically, stood against my colleagues and I at the General Medical Council, saying that vaccines could not cause autism. What he did, and he also stood against American children in the vaccine court here, saying that autism was not caused by vaccines. What he forgot at the time, it appears, that he was the first person to publish a paper saying that vaccines could cause autism. In fact, he reported that in one child, the probable cause was his immunization. And yet he forgot about that. The US vaccine court has been settling cases of vaccine damage where the outcome is autism for some years. And if you want to look up some of the names, then Misty Hyatt against HHS for MMR vaccine. Hannah Poling was a famous case where the father was a neurologist from Johns Hopkins, had nine vaccines on the same day, and Bailey Bank. So the government is saying on the one hand vaccines don't cause autism, and on the other hand is awarding in court for children who have suffered brain damage where the outcome is autism. So the greatest impediments to progress, commercial influence undoubtedly. Vaccines are the new avenue for profit for the pharmaceutical industry. You may have read in the Wall Street Times, the Wall Street Journal, that mainstream drugs are a bust because they're coming off patent. There are no new drugs in the pipeline, and so the profits of the industry are going to suffer dramatically, except for vaccines. There are over 300 new vaccines apparently in testing, many of which will be mandated for children and adults, and there is no liability on the part of the vaccine manufacturer. I hope people realize this, is that a tax is levied on every vaccine that is recommended for children and given, paid for by the provider, by the parent, and that goes into a fund that compensates children damaged by vaccines. The government has indemnified the pharmaceutical industry. If you could make cars where the tire burst and the gas pedal stuck and you didn't care because you weren't going to pay for the damages, why would you take any trouble to improve that car? You wouldn't. So that's the situation that the manufacturers find themselves in. They anticipate 14% annual growth year on year from here on in with their vaccines. So that is what we are up against. Fear of accountability, certainly within the bureaucracies. Ideological denial is actually probably one of the most difficult things to deal with of all. The fundamental belief that we as a medical profession could not have done this. Please don't even tell me we could have done this. We can't. It's a sort of cognitive dissonance that they live with. Media fraud, and Brian Deer is one example of that, which is perpetuated by an elaborate, deceitful and failing public relations campaign throughout the world in order to stop doctors and scientists doing their job. The public relations campaign has failed. It's failed. Last year, there was a poll from the University of Michigan. 25% of parents, American parents, thought vaccines caused autism. This year, it was over 50% in a different poll. Whatever the merits of those two polls, what they tell us is that the public relations campaign has failed. Why? Why? Because it's real. Because it's real. Matt Lauer said to me on television, you know, why hasn't this gone away? I said, because it's real. It's real. And Matt Lauer didn't vaccinate his children on schedule. You might want to know that. It's failed. Not because of me, not because of a scare that I created, because it's real. Because there are so many damaged children. We are looking at an unprecedented level of chronic immune and inflammatory diseases, which for most of us in this room were vanishingly rare or absent altogether when we were at school. For one of the most vaccinated populations in the world, with one of the apparently highest standards of living, why are so many children so sick? And that's the question. It's not going to go away. It is absolutely not going to go away. And therefore, the best thing that the government can do is get on and address it as quickly as possible. So that is part of my job. I'm not going to go away. I'm too pig-headed to go away. The issue is too important. And I've got to tell you, I just love living in exile in Austin. I can't think of a better place in the world to be. And the work will continue. We're building a new center in Austin. What is happening is the sort of tsunami is coming through and the children are now becoming adults. And there's nothing for them at all, nothing. There are no facilities, no, these children, when their parents, and one of the parents say to me, a very sad story that may really focus my attention on this in the UK, is a mother called me from the north of England. She said, Dr. Wakefield, you don't know me. I'm an elderly mother, my husband is infirm, and I have a child with severe autism. When I die, I'm taking him with me. And she said, please don't judge me. And I didn't. I mean, it was not my place to judge her. In fact, I was moved, deeply moved by the love that a mother must have for her child, that she would take his life rather than have him fall on the mercy of a world that really didn't care, for whom there was no provision at all, no services, a child who would die on the streets. And that was in large part a decision point for me in continuing this work. And it's happened. And you'll read in the news time and again that mothers are driving into rivers with their children or smothering their children simply because they've reached a point beyond which they cannot go. And they see a very bleak future, that when they become infirm or they die, what is going to happen to their children? That's why we have to act now to create a safe haven where people can be helped and treated and be safe and be as creative and fulfilled as they possibly can be. And so we're building what is called the Autism Trust here in Austin as the prototype for the rest of America, where there is optimum health care, that businesses are going to be involved, where the children, the adults, can work and live. And it is not going to be a closed environment. It's not going to be an institution. It's going to be open. It's going to be invested in the local horticulture and agriculture and all these kinds of things. But it has to be done now, because society really has not prepared for this catastrophe. And on the back of that, we hope to be able to advance the science rapidly to stop this, to help the children who are affected, and to stop it dead in its tracks. And to do that, what we need to do is separate out the federal government from its friends in the pharmaceutical industry, I believe, and to prevail upon the government to do what it should do and represent the people. So I think it's probably time for me to shut up and sign some books and then go and have a beer. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.